Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you had a superb weekend and it was fun and restful at the same time. We've got a lot of political news during this hour of Air Talk to get to, including Mitt Romney's secret Twitter account. That's coming up a little bit later. But first, we turn our attention to what's going on in northern Syria, where American forces have largely pulled out. Kurdish forces say they're pulling out of portions of northern Syria as well. And with us to talk about this important development is UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies and the co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions, Matt Barreto. Professor, good to have you with us again. First of all, the sort of conflicting day-by-day accounts we're getting of what's happening with U.S. troops in Syria.
Yeah, thank you, Larry, for having me back. I think it's quite troubling, as a number of people have spoken out over the last week or so. We're not really sure what's happening because there's a lack of independent reporting on the ground there. It's, of course, a very dangerous region there on the Turkey and Syria border. And so we're not really sure if this ceasefire is holding, if Turkey is still attacking the Kurdish people who are there, and what's happening. And so we're going to have to wait and see if it's holding. But, you know, I think what is important here is that this was a self-inflicted and unnecessary situation. There were U.S. troops in the region who were keeping an uneasy peace, and now we're seeing a lot of bloodshed. And so we need to continue looking and following this closely to see how we can bring a peaceful solution to this.
Also with us is Republican political analyst Sean T. Walsh. His firm is Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, former advisor to Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, former White House staffer for Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Sean, good to have you with us this morning. President Trump, just meeting with reporters, said in defending his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, that the U.S. never agreed to protect the Kurds forever. Your thoughts about how the president's characterized his decision?
I think this can damage U.S. relations with any group, insurgent group or otherwise, for the next 50 years. I mean, the United States has saved literally probably thousands of lives by having the Kurds be our ground forces, and then we use air power and special forces power. This really, really seems to be a betrayal of people who have given tens of thousands, if not 100,000s of lives in our cause to try and defeat ISIS in that region. Now you've got probably 10,000 ISIS people that have been in prisons that are going free. And more significantly, perhaps, is the fact that Mr. Erdogan, the Turkish president, is in Moscow today meeting with Mr. Putin. The ceasefire is, regardless of whether it was shabbily held up over the weekend, is going to expire tomorrow. And the Turkish army is going to move in mass and try and move the Kurds out of Western Syria.
Well, and it seems that this, along with the president's decision that he was going to hold the G summit at his Doral Golf Club in South Florida, that these particularly rubbed congressional Republicans the wrong way, in a way more than it seems the rough transcript of his call with the Ukrainian president. And what's your sense, Sean, of how much of the president's support is eroded over these two issues?
Well, I think, Larry, you hit the nail on the head. I do believe that if Republicans come on board with regards to an impeachment, articles of impeachment, or at least willing to entertain them, it is largely because of President Trump's move in this region. Not only do you have Erdogan in Moscow meeting with Putin, but Erdogan now is insisting on getting nuclear weapons, and perhaps Russia may provide him with those nuclear weapons. I mean, this is just really an awful, awful, almost disastrous foreign policy problem for the United States, and it was completely and utterly of the president's own making.
Why do you think he did it?
Because if you look at President Trump, he made certain campaign pledges when he was running for office, and he has not deviated from those campaign pledges. So he said he's going to bring home foreign troops. They shouldn't be involved in foreign wars, and he's doing exactly that. That said, once you come into an office, when you make campaign pledges, you have people who educate you as to whether the viability of whether a campaign pledge can be honored or not. And I think that this president has moved against all of his national security, or most of his national security team, both inside and outside of the four walls of the White House, who said don't do it. And because he made that pledge, he's going to do it. And I just think to honor a political pledge, he's made a tremendous, disastrous national security decision.
Well, and the way he did it, Matt, I'm curious what you think, because he had this phone call with the Turkish President Erdogan before President Trump made the announcement of the troop withdrawal. So if in fact he decided this is the time I'm going to hold to this campaign pledge and withdraw our troops from Syria, wouldn't you think he would have extracted a pledge from Erdogan, some sort of an agreement that they would not go into Syria against the Kurds?
Well, it seems like he gave him the green light in that discussion. It doesn't seem like there was any, discussion about strategy or long-term solutions to what has been a centuries-old problem. So that was a complete failure on their part to not strategize and have that vision. But, you know, it's not even clear if he's going to bring these troops home. I mean, the news today suggests that they're just moving over into Iraq nearby to monitor the situation, at least 500 U.S. troops. And so he's pulling them out of Syria and Turkey in this region where they were providing stability and preventing this chaos. And he's not necessarily bringing them back to the United States. He's just moving them over to another country to sort of wait and see what happens if we have to then get back involved after things get even worse. You know, it's going to really, I think, blow up in his face. And this was just not a well thought out foreign policy strategy.
We're talking with UCLA professor Matt Barreto, Republican political analyst Sean Walsh. The deposing of individuals as part of the impeachment inquiry continues with House committees. In the meantime, White House Chief of Staff, the acting Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, in a news conference, a news briefing last Thursday, was attempting to describe what President Trump had arranged with Ukraine about the investigations into allegations that Ukraine had a role in the hacking of the Democratic National Committee in 2016.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. We were holding up money at the same time for, what was it, the Northern Triangle countries. We were holding up aid at the Northern Triangle countries so that they would change their policies on immigration. And I have news for everybody. Get over it.
And so, first of all, he attempted in the news conference to say there was no quid pro quo involving the Bidens. That was not the issue on which the aid to Ukraine was being withheld. But he seemed to pretty clearly indicate, Sean, that aid was being withheld pending an agreement on the part of Ukraine's government that it would investigate any involvement in the 2016 election, which might have attempted to harm Trump's candidacy. So is this significant in your view? He then later went back and said, no, there wasn't a quid pro quo for that.
Well, a couple of things. Maybe too inside baseball, but I've talked to a number of folks back in Washington, and President Trump seems to be obsessed on a Don Quixote-like way with regards to the company called CrowdStrike, and that's the group that may have, he believes, or some people believe, conspiracy theorists, that they actually took a copy of one of the servers and brought it back to Ukraine, and that would demonstrate that it wasn't really a Trump-Russia issue, but it was another thing altogether. So the president is still obsessed and focused on the Mueller issue. My view is, you know, that's water under the bridge, move on, but he's still obsessed for it, and he wants to bootstrap that issue forward. With regards to Mick Mulvaney, I think partly and largely a big part of his problem was the fact that because the White House doesn't do normal briefings, doesn't stand up, once Mr. Mulvaney made that comment, Stephanie Grisham, the press secretary, should have stood right up there and had that clarified right there on the spot. Instead of doing that, Mulvaney came back to Stephanie's office and said, hey, how'd I do? And she said, look, we got a lot of fixing to do. They put Mulvaney out for 4 days to try and clean up his mess in that press conference. And, you know, it was just too nuanced for most of the public to understand. And I don't think he did a good job. So you took a story that now goes into 5 days.
We'll continue our conversation with our analysts, Sean Walsh and Matt Barreto. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the other aspects of the impeachment inquiry and the 2020 presidential race, including Elizabeth Warren said that she'll be releasing her funding mechanism for her Medicare for All program in the near future. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're joined by our political analyst this week, Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies. He also co-founded the polling and research firm Latino Decisions. And Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. His firm is Wilson Walsh Consulting, based in San Francisco. We're talking about the top political news of the week. Matt, one of the things that seems, I think, surprising to most political observers is President Trump was surprised, it seems, or at least says he was surprised, that there was so much pushback to his idea of hosting the G7 summit at his Doral Country Club in South Florida, that he figured Democrats would be mad because, of course, they're mad at everything he does, but that he was surprised that this so offended Republicans. How would it be that he wouldn't think they would have been upset about that?
Well, first of all, let me just say that both Sean and I want to get one of those Larry Mantle bobbleheads.
All right,
save two for us.
You got it.
No, I think that this comes with Trump's lack of experience in the political setting. He's used to sort of just running his company as, you know, a dictator, essentially, that he just implements policy and he has staff and workers that implement everything he wants. And so when he gets to Washington, D.C., and it's not just on this G7 summit, but on a number of things, he has been surprised by how much diplomacy and politicking needs to take place for things to move forward. And so on this one in particular, you know, he runs the risk not only of it looking bad while he's under the impeachment inquiry, you know, and I think a lot of Senate Republicans were saying, hey, this is just making it very hard for us to defend you. But it also runs right up on the edge of the emoluments clause and not, you know, forcing government contracts to do business with you so that you can profit from that. And so it could further entangle him in the impeachment inquiry. So far, those have been focused on Ukraine, but there's no telling if another committee decides to take up his business strategy and the fact that he never, you know, got rid of his business interests.
Well, and he laid it out like, well, of course, this is logical. It would cost the federal government less. It's the perfect location. It's close to Miami Airport. All these, each delegation could have its own, you know, casitas as a part of this. So he's sort of laying out, well, here's logically why it makes sense. But Sean, it's as though he didn't understand how this would be perceived.
I think that's a charitable way of describing whether he understood it or not. And everything you said is right, and he probably is right. But, you know, you have six separate committees now engaged in a variety of impeachment issues. And this is what annoys Republicans to no end. It's not only do you, you know, try and mitigate issues that are being raised, but you throw gas on the fire. So I think the emoluments clause is probably the weakest of all the issues that they're looking at. And having a business like Mr. Trump, it's awful hard to unwind. And I don't think he's making a lot of money or profit off of that. But again, it's the perception, and it just gives more fuel to the fire for the Democrats. And Republicans are just tired. They're tired of all of this stuff. They're tired of what's going to come up today, tomorrow, and the next day with a flurry of tweets. So I just think the president better be very, very careful, because he's got his core base. But there are a number of Republicans that I think just have Trump fatigue.
Mitch McConnell apparently has been talking with his fellow Republican senators and saying that he thinks an impeachment trial is virtually inevitable. And he's talking about 6 days a week for, you know, a couple of months. I don't remember how long the Bill Clinton impeachment trial lasted, Sean, but Is there any way that does anything other than damage to the president, even if the Senate doesn't remove him?
Well, it does do damage to the president. You know, some people I've heard, even on this program, say, oh, well, Donald Trump wants to have impeachment because it will hurt the Democrats and they'll lose their seats, like what happened with the Bill Clinton impeachment. And I don't believe that. It's a pox on everybody's house. Yeah, it does hurt some Democrats if they overreach, but it really does fundamentally weaken the president. And I think the goal and what McConnell said was get it done fast, trying to get it done before the new year, before the, you know, going into the election cycle in January and February. So if it happens, I think Pelosi would probably want to drag it out into the beginning of next year, and McConnell would like to have it done before the end of the year.
Matt Barreto, what do you see as the effect of a lengthy legal process like that in the Senate?
Well, I think, you know, new evidence is coming out every day. And so the longer it drags out, the longer there is not only for new evidence to come out, new testimony to come out, but also for Trump's responses. I think this is one of the points that Sean has been making that I agree with, is that the unpredictability of Trump's responses when he feels cornered in or penned in adds fuel to the fire. And so the longer that gets drawn out, he's not going to be able to help himself, but he's going to be tweeting and really bashing the impeachment inquiry, including he's likely to eventually start bashing McConnell himself for even just allowing this to go forward, even though he's constitutionally required. And let's not forget, you have Senator Romney, who has now been a critic of President Trump again. And so he's going to be one of the jurors in the Senate, as well as Lindsey Graham, who said, well, if there's evidence, I'm going to have to consider it. So there could be a handful of Republicans who are thorns in his side. And the longer this drags out, it's just going to look like more infighting. And that infighting is what he wants to avoid.
Let's listen to the clip of what Matt just referenced there. Last night on Axios on HBO, a Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, who's been one of the president's strongest supporters, though certainly not on the Syria issue, was asked whether he would support impeaching the president.
Sure. Show me something that is a crime. If you could show me that, you know, Trump actually was engaging in a quid pro quo outside the phone call, that would be very disturbing.
The Lindsey Graham on Axios on HBO last night. Mitt Romney was just mentioned by Matt as well. And we have confirmation this morning from the Utah senator that for years he's been operating a secret Twitter account under the handle Pierre Delecto. Sean, what do you think of this?
Well, I know a number of folks, consultants as well, who had secret Twitter accounts and were putting things out to have their perspective put forward or defend themselves. I think it's nothing but trouble. You know, you're not a nom de plume person back in the constitutional days where you wrote under another name because you thought the British were going to prosecute you. I think it's a political mistake. Now, I know it seems to be fairly innocent and he wasn't pushing stuff out. He was following his kids. At least that's what the story is. But
he was,
you know,
responding,
in this day
and age, though, to some columns and things that were critical of him, you know, not, you know, violently, you know, coming back at them. But he was sort of using it to spar with people.
Yeah, and it just, honestly, Larry, it just makes you suspect of a person that they're doing things under, you know, the cloak of anonymity, and it makes you wonder about their character a little bit. Now, Romney likes to, you know, present himself as a Dudley Do-Right, you know, always says the nice thing and is this cleaner than clean politician, but I think that undermines his credibility a bit.
Well, it's funny that even in a fake account, which, you know, a lot of professional athletes used to go after their critics in much harsher terms than Mitt Romney's case, it's pretty mild in the criticism or defense of himself in the third person that he engages in. Matt, what do you think about the political effect of this?
I think it's that big of a deal. I mean, if you look at the actual tweets he was responding to and sending, I mean, it's not a very active Twitter account. You know, he, as you just described, I mean, these were not, he wasn't throwing bombs and starting big debates on Twitter. He was, I think, using it more to keep tabs. The point it does raise is why, if he is so outspoken and honest, why wasn't he just doing this from his own Twitter account? Why did he need to create this other one to try to and defend himself? And that's an important question for him to answer, because he has taken the stance that, hey, I'm willing to stand up and say, call out things that I don't think are right. Yet he doesn't want to do that from his official account. I think that's the mistake he made. Not necessarily any of the tweets in there seem pretty mild to me.
He's had it for 8 years, apparently. What a great name, Pierre Delecto. And he's got 8 followers of that Twitter account. We're talking about Mitt Romney, who this morning, after CNN had reported last night, or actually was The Atlantic's McKay Coppins reported last night that Mitt Romney was linked to this account. Romney then you said that, yes, it was his account. We're talking politics with Matt Barreto, UCLA professor, and Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. Before we break, Matt, we hear that Elizabeth Warren is going to release some details about how she's going to fund her Medicare for All plan, on which she was hit from multiple angles in last Tuesday night's Democratic debate. How is she going to be able to spin this or talk about this in a way that is going to deal with concerns about middle class tax hikes?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty similar to the funding proposals you've already seen from Senator Sanders. And she has tried to describe those, I think, in the various debates and the interviews she's given. And from her perspective, the argument is that while there will be some tax increases, those will be almost entirely paid for by what she describes as the super wealthy. But this will make your premiums go away and the other expenses you have. And so for the average family, including up to people who make well into $100,000 or $200,000, their taxes will be a lot lower on average. So we'll wait for the details, but that appears to be what she's saying.
Yeah, and certainly a lot of economists question that, whether there's enough money there in the super high earners that you could possibly do that without increasing taxes on the middle class. And since most people aren't heavy health care users, you run the risk of the typical middle class person heavily subsidizing the people with the very high medical expenses. We'll talk about that as we continue. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Our political analysts with us this week are Sean Walsh, Republican analyst with Wilson Walsh Consulting, and Matt Barreto, professor of political science and Chicano studies at UCLA. We're just talking about Elizabeth Warren, who is at least the co-front runner for the Democratic nomination at this point. Sean, we're supposed to get soon, according to the senator's team, her financial plan to fund her Medicare for All plan. But this is going to be one of her biggest challenges, it would seem, to answer this question about the finances.
Well, it's not just the Medicare for All plan. I mean, she just proposed quadrupling the amount of federal government spending for public schools. So, I mean, every plan she has, and she likes to brag that she's got a plan for everything, involves massive amounts of increased government spending. And you know, President Trump has not kept his eye on the Treasury. The money's been flowing out as much faster than it's been coming in. And if you look at her spending plans, it's just not sustainable. So I think that were I Democrats who are trying to chip away at her, Joe Biden, I would play more as a fiscal conservative, that when he was in the Senate, he supported Bill Clinton's policies that helped to balance the budget. And I would try and nail her back on that. And I think she is vulnerable for being just a complete spender.
Well, and Senator Amy Klobuchar, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, also got some fundraising bumps and attention bumps after the last debate, in which they were rather sharply critical of Elizabeth Warren's plan. Matt, do you think that there is space there for them on this issue?
I think that the mood right now in the Democratic primary electorate in the base is more in line with what Senator Warren and Senator Sanders are proposing to push back against the Trump tax cuts for the wealthy. And there might be more government spending, but it's going to be paid for by the super wealthy paying their fair share. And so there's, you know, these debates are important for those outside candidates who are on the outer edges of the debate stage to get in their talking points, to take a chance at attacking, or not attacking, but taking a heavy criticism at the front runners. And so, you know, I thought it was good. I thought it was a good debate. And it was also good for Senator Warren to face those questions so that she could fine tune and go back. But I really do think you're going to see Senator Warren, Senator Sanders, who seems to be resurging a little bit, continue with this momentum. There's a lot of support within the base for these ideas that we need to be providing more opportunities for everyone, especially on these issues of public education and public access to health insurance. These are things that everyone should have an opportunity to have access to. And that is a very, very strong mood in the Democratic base right now.
Matt, I also wanted to ask you about Bernie Sanders, because he looked well in the debate last week after having the two stents inserted, and clearly the squad coming out with their endorsements of him, you know, showing that they stand by him despite the heart attack that he had. What's your sense of where Sanders stands at this point, especially related to the candidate closest to him, Warren?
Well, I think it was important for him to have that strong debate. He did. He looked like his old self. He was much more practiced on this issue of how to pay for health care, and I thought he was very sharp on that. And then he followed that up with this large rally. So just from a perception standpoint, I thought that was important for him. Over the long run, I think that Warren is going to continue to erode his support. She has a little bit more momentum. There's a little bit more enthusiasm behind her because Sanders had his opportunity. He ran in 16, and it was a lot easier for him when it was a one-on-one contest where he represented the entire progressive wing of the Democratic Party against Hillary Clinton. Now he has to share that, not just with Warren, but other candidates like Castro and Booker and others have a lot of those same, Harris, have a lot of those same progressive stances. So it was a good debate for Sanders. It was a good follow-up weekend for him. But I still think that Warren is the candidate to watch.
Sean, it's interesting because Warren is certainly the more adept debater. But Bernie Sanders still has a kind of cult-like following where people really love him. There's a personal connection that he seems to make that Warren is still, you know, despite her great skill as a public speaker and debater, she's still working on that.
Well, I mean, there are the Bernie bros, but at some juncture you get down to practicalities, and delegates get down to practicalities, and they say, who's going to win? And, you know, you've got a man in Bernie Sanders. I think if he were elected president on Election Day, he'd be 76 years old and he had a heart attack. So, you know, I'm hesitant to be overly, you know, pushing on the ageism, but he's old, Biden's old, Warren's old, but Warren doesn't come off as old, and she doesn't come off as a person who's got, you know, coronary, you know, heart disease. So,
well, and she's a woman, and women live longer. So her 70 isn't as old as a man's 70 would be.
And I just think it's inescapable that that's going to be a factor that people are going to be thinking about. So, and they also draw from the same kind of group. So, I mean, I think if I were the Democrats, probably about the worst thing that can happen is if you still have a tight bunching of Sanders, Biden, and Warren going closer towards your convention. And if you don't have a breakout person there, then you've got a really interesting and potentially bloody fight at your convention.
Sean, can you explain a bit of what's going on with the Tulsi Gabbard, her candidacy, and in the debate she's talking about, you know, people being on CNN and describing her as a Russian asset. Hillary Clinton suggested that Russia would support a third party candidacy for Gabbard. What's this about?
Well, I will tell you, I think that Booker, Castro, or Rourke, even Klobuchar and Gabbard all have to start thinking about, you know, their exit strategies from the election. And what Hillary Clinton did was almost single-handedly keep Gabbard in the race for another month or two, and she's a big thorn in the side of a number of those candidates. So what I was told before I went on the program this morning is that Ms. Clinton got a briefing. She still keeps very close contact with folks in the State Department and the intelligence community, the deep state, as they say. And there are people that are very skeptical that she's just being used, not that she's necessarily an agent of Putin, but just being used in a manipulative sort of way. And she just went off script with the guy on a podcast that she's known and has been a consultant to her for a long time. So she stepped out of line okay. and spoke her private mind. Yeah.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left, and I do want to make note of Congressman Elijah Cummings passing last week. He was 68 years old, and his death took a lot of people by surprise. He's one of the point members of the House on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump, longtime civil rights advocate, Baltimore-based attorney. Matt, your thoughts on the legacy of Elijah Cummings?
Well, certainly he was a very important voice in the Democratic Party, but especially in the African-American community. And even most recently, he popped up again in this fight that Trump and his folks were having with the city of Baltimore as a longtime defender of Baltimore and the success that he has helped shepherd through there. So it's not only a loss of where we are now, but if you look at the career of Cummings and what he has meant to inclusion as he has his career in the House really took off. He was a very, very important voice and one that will be sadly missed.
Sean, just a quick thought on the legacy of Congressman Cummings.
Well, I think he was a powerful person and people looked towards him. He also had a mixed record. His wife was, you know, accused of some corruption issues, and Baltimore is one of the toughest cities in America from a lifestyle and living perspective, and they had riots in Baltimore. So it's a mixed legacy from a civil rights perspective, very, very positive, but I think the younger African Americans are looking to new leadership.
He chaired the House Oversight Committee. I want to thank our political analyst for being with us today on Air Talk. That's Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, and Professor Matt Barreto, Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies at UCLA, also co-founded Latino Decisions, the research and polling firm. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming off this most recent California legislative session, there's a big gap between what Governor Newsom had promised during his campaign for governor and what he and the legislature ultimately ended up delivering. The Los Angeles Times recently did a Q&A with the governor focused on what he thought about his administration on the issue of housing. And he said it wasn't a problem that could be solved overnight. He pointed to legislation like State Senator Scott Wiener's bill, SB 50, which was designed to increase the density of housing in single-family neighborhoods that were close to transit lines. But of course, the question with that is, where are residents who live in those single family communities, and how much are they going to be willing to tolerate with higher density coming into the places where they live? The pressure for these kinds of bills like SB 50 is only going to be increasing with a housing crisis here in Southern California. And that pits those single family communities against members of the state legislature. Joining us to talk about this important issue going forward is David Garcia, policy director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation in UC Berkeley. David, thank you very much for being with us. First of all, it's my assumption we're only going to see the pressure for this kind of zoning change ratcheting up. Do you think it more likely something sweeping like this passes next session?
Well, good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back. I do think, given the significant wins that happened this last session on funding for affordable housing, on tenant protections, there's going to be a significant focus on doing something more sweeping around the land use reform in the state of California. In some respects, California is playing a bit of catch-up. If you look at what Oregon did last year, they passed significant reforms on opening up exclusionary single-family neighborhoods, and I think you're going to see a lot of the same discussions here in California, particularly because we have Senate Bill 50 that is slated to be brought back in the second year of this session.
Also with us, former Los Angeles County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky, who directs the Los Angeles Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. Zev, also a former member of the LA City Council. Zev is going to be speaking at the Sherman Oaks Homeowner Association about the future of single-family neighborhoods. This issue is very close to Sherman Oaks residents' hearts, given that they are very close to transit and could see significant changes in their community if a bill like SB 50 were to pass in the next session. Zev, it's good to have you with us again. Do you think it's inevitable these single-family communities are going to change?
Well, I don't know whether it's inevitable or not, but I don't think there's been a really thorough discussion about what this bill, the SB 50 bill, does. When we talk about transit, you know, all of us want to see more housing around transit and more development around transit. It makes common sense. But the way the state law defines transit is any bus line, any local bus line that runs once every 10 minutes during the peak hours, that's every commercial street in the Los Angeles Basin. That means that the entire Los Angeles Basin would be rezoned for seven-story buildings with no limits on density, with practically no requirements on parking. That's what that bill does. It's not just about housing near transit. When people think of transit and major transit stops, they think of the red line, the blue line, the green line. They don't think of the Melrose bus or the Cesar Chavez bus in Boyle Heights, or the Crenshaw bus or the Vermont bus in South Los Angeles. Every neighborhood in Los Angeles, for all intents and purposes, would be rezoned. And it's not just about, you know, there are appropriate places to increase density. And the city of Los Angeles is doing that as we speak. And they've been criticized. Some of the mayor has, and some of the city council members have been criticized for increasing zoning. In fact, last year, the city issued permits for more apartment buildings than they have in any single year since 1981. So the bills that have passed in Sacramento over the last several years, and there have been dozens and dozens of them, including this past session, have had an impact, and the economy has had an impact. But make no mistake, Larry, that new construction in this town is in California is not going to produce affordable housing. It's producing high-end housing, market-rate housing. And if you're going to increase density in places, and Los Angeles certainly has been doing that, my beef with the city and with the state and with Scott Wiener's bill is that it didn't demand anything in return from the landowner. When you double or triple the density of my property, you've just doubled or tripled the value of my property. I ought to give something back for that windfall. And that something should be that a significant percentage of the units, not 10%, not 15%, but 40 or 50% or more, should be set aside for affordable housing, which 40% of the people who live in Los Angeles County need to live in affordable housing. They have average incomes of household incomes of less than $60,000 a year.
But Zev, you know the developers are going to say that just doesn't pencil out. We can't build that many subsidized housing units and make a profit.
That's not necessarily the case. And that's, you know, when you increase somebody's property value and give them the right to build unlimited density and don't require him to put up parking, he's getting a windfall. And that's why the real estate industry and the high tech industry is funding the whole campaign to get SB 50 and similar legislation passed. This is a windfall for them. Get something in return. And let's find out what that sweet spot is. How much density do they need in order to set aside a significant percentage for affordable housing? But the crisis in this state is the affordable housing crisis. It's not housing. If you're making $150,000 a year, if you can afford to spend $2,800 or $3,200 a month on a one-bedroom apartment, there's no shortage of them in Los Angeles. I don't know about the rest of the state, but certainly not in Southern California. But if you're making a minimum wage, you can't afford anything close to $2,000 or $2,500 a month for any housing unit. And those are the people we have to be concerned about. The reason Scott Wiener's bill didn't pass the first time he put it up is because the affordable housing advocates went nuts on it, because there was nothing in there for affordable housing, which should tell you something about what's motivating that bill. And then in the second iteration, SB 50, they put up they dressed it up a little bit with some so-called affordable housing provisions, which were very minimal and cosmetic. And so that's the issue. And the tragedy of all this debate is that if you rezone all the single family homes in Los Angeles County and in California for multiple dwelling units, buildings, you're not going to create an more affordable housing, but you're going to destroy a lot of communities.
Well, and what's here for the longtime residents, the homeowners who are going to see these large structures go up in their communities, Ev?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
What do they get back from this? Because this would have a negative effect on the typical single family home's value, right? Unless it's being sold to a developer to be torn down and redeveloped.
Well, that's right, and that's what the developers are counting on. They'll come to you and they'll say, Mr. Mantle, I'd like to buy your house. And by the way, I bought the house next to you on that side and next to you on that side. If you don't sell it to me, your house isn't going to be worth, you know, the paper it's written on, and you'll sell. And that's what they're doing. That's what happens every time a massive rezoning has happened. And let me tell you, Portland, Minneapolis, which have tried this, South Chicago, which has tried this densification, this ending of single family homes, that hasn't done a thing to, it hasn't scratched the surface on the affordability question. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have to build more housing. And there's a lot of housing being built in Los Angeles today. There's tons of housing being built on the West Side, which is one of the most affluent neighborhoods in the country. It's happening, but it's not affordable to the people who most need the housing and who are being bumped out of their housing and onto the streets of the city. And well, so we have to be honest about it. And if we're going to have a discussion about densifying, then we have to have a discussion about who benefits from it, aside from the real estate industry.
And what about the issue of control? Is this something that local communities should fully control? Should the state be able to bigfoot it with a bill and say, hey, you guys aren't doing your part. We're going to take over and mandate what you have to do.
Well, I'm a local government official, historically for 40 years, and I'm partial to local government knowing, you know, what's best in their communities. Los Angeles has a plan concept that was developed by our former planning director back in the 70s, Cal Hamilton. It was called the centers concept, where you'd have major centers like downtown and Hollywood and Van Nuys and NoHo and Westwood. Century City, those were the centers. And then you'd have medium density areas, which would have, it wouldn't be single family, but they wouldn't be high rise skyscrapers. And then you'd have single family homes in low density areas. And that's been the concept by which we've been living for.
All right. Zev, I need to wrap, and I know you need to run too, but thank you very much. Zev Yaroslavsky, who is a director of the Los Angeles Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs, former LA County Supervisor and former LA City Councilman. We'll continue our conversation with David Garcia, our other guest, in a moment. Just want to assure you, we are keeping our eyes on the brush fire in Pacific Palisades. It's just about an acre in size. It was first reported just less than an hour ago near the 500 block of North Palisades Drive. The fire is burning uphill. Fortunately, there's not wind at that location right now, so that's to the benefit of firefighters who are trying to extinguish it. But the fire is burning towards homes. There have been no evacuations called for at this point, but it's not a complete brush area. There are homes that are nearby. Right now, we're talking about the future of single-family neighborhoods here in Southern California, as each year the pressure to increase density in suburban areas of major California cities increases. And the question is, what is it that would make residents of those single-family home communities more comfortable with denser development? Is there anything that could come with that or not? I'd like to hear from you at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. From UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation, Policy Director David Garcia. So, David, your response to what we heard from Zev Yaroslavsky.
Yeah, so a couple of things. I think it's important to note that Zev is right that the market is never really going to produce truly affordable housing that is affordable to the families making the least amounts of income in our communities. That being said, I don't think it's fair to characterize a bill that would reform land use as solely benefiting market rate developers, because affordable housing developers have a very small, limited area in which they are allowed to develop today, mostly because we've concentrated areas in where dense multifamily housing is being built, even though we need that for not just high income earners, but lower middle income earners as well. That's why groups like Habitat for Humanity and some others are supportive of land use reforms, not just in California, but throughout the country. Another thing that we need to consider is that this simply is not just saying we need to build more housing in single family neighborhoods simply for the sake of building housing there. This is really an issue of inclusiveness. And that if you look at the areas that have the highest life expectancies, the highest educational outcomes, those are overwhelmingly single-family neighborhoods. And this country and the state has a history of very exclusive and intentionally exclusive planning that keeps certain folks who rent out of these communities. So it's a bit of a social justice issue as well.
So your view is that people who rent should have access to rent in any community?
So I think that is an argument that a lot of folks who are for significant land use reform will make, in that, you know, the best schools, the best amenities are oftentimes kept in these more low density single family areas. And so a lot of Californians will never have the opportunity to live there, either because there is no rental housing there, or to buy a single family home there is simply out of reach.
Of course, you make the argument, the reason in many cases those schools are so good, it's the residents who were there that for whatever historic reasons or otherwise have helped to cultivate those schools. Damien Lemert Park, where gentrification has been a huge issue, says, I think what needs to be talked about is the experience on the ground for low-income residents and people of color when they see these developers coming into their communities. David Garcia, this has been hugely controversial with planned large-scale developments in the Baldwin Hills and Lemert Park areas of Southwest L.A.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely something that should be taken into account when we talk about these large-scale land use reforms. And I think SB 50 did a part of that. And as that bill moves forward, my understanding is that there are ongoing conversations to try to incorporate these concerns, things like first right of return, not allowing developers to utilize any sort of density increases if they have evicted the tenant on site. I think there's a lot of measures that can be incorporated into any bill that reforms land use to make sure that the most vulnerable residents are not negatively impacted as a consequence of that policy.
Teresa in Studio City said one of the reasons that we as residents of these single-family communities have a problem with big increases in multifamily units is that the city doesn't at the same time provide additional green space. So their argument is, if you're going to make it denser, you've got to have more open space for people to access. I don't think that's included in any of these pro-housing bills, though, is it, David?
Yeah, it's not. I would say that most cities have kind of decided how they would like to prioritize that specific issue. So some cities require development fees to be paid into a fund to pay for more green space, to pay for parks. Other cities will negotiate directly with developers to try and get them to incorporate green space or public space into their development. So that's really, up until this point, been done on a case-by-case basis by individual cities.
Of course, the challenge is getting enough space if these are all individual developer parcels to do that. Thank you so much, David Garcia, UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation. Also joining us is Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco. Senator, good to have you with us again. What are your plans for the next legislative session for something like, son of SB 50 or something to mandate more housing in California?
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry for the background noise. I'm outside now. Well, we don't need a son of SB 50 because SB 50 is still alive and well. It was made a two-year bill, which means that instead of being passed in this current year, it gets moved to next year. So the bill will be eligible to come up in the Senate for a vote in January, and that's what we intend to do. We are continuing to work with stakeholders around the state, advocates, local governments, and so forth, to refine the bill, but we're committed to passing it.
We were talking with former L.A. County Supervisor and former L.A. City Councilman Zev Yaroslavsky on this issue. And, you know, his argument was that a bill like SB 50, what it really does is mandate that there's more housing. But in a city like Los Angeles, it's all going to be high end. Very little is going to be what people who are minimum wage earners, even with two people working, would be able to afford. And that this really ends up benefiting developers building expensive projects. Your response to that?
I just don't agree with that at all. The reality is that California has a 3.5 million home deficit. We are literally short 3.5 million homes. And just in the sheer numbers, in terms of homes per capita, comparing the number of housing units versus number of people, we are 49 out of 50 states. So we just need a lot more housing of all varieties. And the reality is that right now, all housing is expensive because there's not enough of it. And so, yes, you start building housing, it's all expensive. But over time, it becomes less expensive as you close the deficit. And to say, well, we're short 3.5 million homes, and if you start building housing, the first ones you build are going to be expensive, so therefore don't build anything, it just makes no sense. And what SB 50 does is it says that as we build more housing, let's make sure that it's legal under the zoning to put it near public transportation and near jobs, because what we don't want to do is create more sprawl, right? Because if we don't allow housing near where the jobs are, near where transit is, it's going to get built further and further away. It's going to be sprawl, covering up farmland. People are going to have to commute 2 hours to work and put more carbon into the atmosphere. So what Zev Yaroslavsky is advocating, what he's advocating is that we build the housing as sprawl further and further away. And that is terrible for the environment. It's terrible for many reasons. So we need to put that housing where the jobs are so people don't have to commute 2 hours to work.
Well, his argument actually was that because you're taking single-family homes and that now is going to host multi-unit large structures, you've increased the value of the land so much that then there should be a quid pro quo with the developers that they do a much higher percentage of affordable housing, that he was saying something like 40% of the units would be affordable for those like two people making minimum wage, that they could live there, but that's not included in SB 50. So he was talking about that, not suburban development.
Well, first of all, having multi-unit is going to be a lot more affordable than having a single-family home. In big swaths of Los Angeles and the Bay Area, single-family homes are incredibly expensive, and most people would never be able to afford it. So let's be very clear. Single-family homes in a lot of L.A. are not affordable to just about anyone that I know. But we do have a strong requirement for affordability in these projects under SB 50, up to 25%. Which is higher than what's required in LA, it's higher than what's required in San Francisco. It's a high requirement, and we're committed to that. In addition, a lot of affordable housing nonprofit developers, these are the organizations that build affordable housing for low-income people, many of them are supporting this bill because when you have single-family home zoning, when all you allow are single-family homes, that is a ban on affordable housing. So what Zev Yaroslavsky is advocating in defending single family home zoning is to continue a ban on building affordable housing.
All right. I want to thank you, Senator Wiener, for joining us. I appreciate it very much. Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco. He's the author of SB 50. The bill is continuing into the next session of the California legislature. You can share your comments about the future of single-family home neighborhoods in Greater Los Angeles on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Tomorrow night, the NBA season gets underway, and the gravity of the league has truly moved to Southern California, with both the LA Clippers and the Lakers overhauling their rosters with stars atop both of those teams. The early favorite for the NBA championship are the LA Clippers, with Kawhi Leonard, the free agent who was signed after leading the Toronto Raptors to last year's NBA title. But he is going to be joined once he recovers from injury by Paul George, acquired in a big trade with Oklahoma City. So you got the two stars atop the Clippers, and the Lakers, of course, with the acquisition of Anthony Davis coming to Los Angeles to join LeBron James, Kyle Kuzma, the young player whose star is ascending. He won't be in the lineup tomorrow night, but he's going to be there with their big three. Joining us to talk about the NBA in LA is A. Martinez, host of Take Two, and for many years the host of pre- and post-game Laker Conversation on the Lakers station, ESPN LA. It's an exciting year for NBA fans here.
Yeah, I've always dreamed of an all-Staples Center Western Conference Finals, because if the Clippers and Lakers manage to get as far as all the experts deem that they will, that's what's going to happen. Both teams should square off if they're going to be right for the right to be in the NBA Finals, which would be pretty exciting around LA.
Now, do the players get their per diem if they're both playing in LA?
Because one would be the road team.
So,
so they all get their they get their money, Larry. They definitely get their money.
The Clippers, by the way, are the home team for tomorrow night's game at Staples. Also with us, Los Angeles Lakers beat writer for The Athletic, Bill Oram. Bill, good to have you with us again. Exciting time to be covering the Lakers.
Yeah, Larry, it's funny. I started covering the Lakers in 2013, which was the season after Kobe Bryant suffered that torn Achilles tendon that so dramatically reshaped the immediate future of the franchise. So I've never covered the Lakers in the playoffs, and I'm willing to go out on a limb here along with A and say I think this will be the year that I will actually work past April 15th.
Yeah, for them not to make the playoffs would be a meltdown so catastrophic by sports standards, it would be hard to fathom. So, Bill, your assessment of the Lakers, putting two big stars like this together, that sometimes takes a while to gel, doesn't it?
It can, and, you know, we've seen this with LeBron James in the past. When you go back to his first season in Miami with that big three along with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, that team started very slowly. Obviously, last year with LeBron joining up with the young guys the Lakers had, they started 2-5. But when you go back to that Heat year, they still made the finals that year. They ultimately lost to the Mavericks, but that was a year that they were able to get things together in what was a pretty wide open Eastern Conference and get to the championship round. I would expect this Lakers group, just because of its all the veteran presence you find on this roster, with not just Anthony Davis and LeBron James, but guys like Avery Bradley, Danny Green, JaVale McGee, Rajon Rondo. You don't have a lot of teaching to do in the training camp. That has been a real theme from first-year coach Frank Vogel, another new guy, where really this is a group that has players who've been through the battles before. So while they're getting to know each other, they don't need to get to know the NBA game, really. So there are going to be some growing pains. There will be ups and downs. But there is at least an internal belief that this is a group that can, for the most part, hit the ground running.
I'm a big Danny Green fan. I think he's going to be a big help. And also, to me, Kyle Kuzma is really sort of the secret to this whole thing. If he continues to improve year over year, that's going to be a very potent third option.
Yeah, this stress fracture that he's got with his foot is a little annoying, I think, to a lot of Laker fans who were envisioning him taking that next step and maybe being part of a big three at some point with Anthony Davis and LeBron James. But yeah, he is someone that if the Lakers do wind up in the playoffs, it's because Kyle Kuzma has elevated his game to be the third option that the Lakers have behind James and Davis. If there is some issues with his stress fracture, if the Lakers are somewhat struggling, it's probably because Kyle Kuzma has not been able to contribute. So there, he is a pendulum in a way. Where he swings, I think, is where the Lakers season swings as well.
Now, Bill, what about Frank Vogel, the Lakers coach? He has NBA experience, of course. He took a year's sabbatical when he was out of work. What does he bring in leadership?
Well, I mean, certainly a guy who's been through kind of the rigors of the NBA. You have to remember, he was the coach of the Indiana Pacers when they met LeBron James and the Miami Heat 3 straight years in the postseason. And there really wasn't a team that challenged that Heat super team like Frank Vogel's Pacers. In 3 years, he played the Heat 30 times. So if there's a guy who knows LeBron James, at least from the other side, it's Frank Vogel. And so I've actually spoken with him about what that history has done and how it has helped inform the way he's going to approach coaching him this year. He had some interesting thoughts on that. LeBron is the point guard of this team, both in title and deed, as opposed to just in functionality, which has kind of always been the case. And Vogel said that part of what got him on board with that plan was going back and rewatching his old Pacers series against the Heat and watching the way LeBron conducted that offense. So I do think that the history between those two, albeit as rivals, is going to be really valuable here, but also a defensive-minded coach, a tactician, and he really wants to focus on the defensive end. He has a guy in LeBron James who is going to be able to quarterback the offense, who can really think the game, but also an assistant coach, Jason Kidd, who is one of the great offensive maestros
yeah.
the last couple of decades as well. So while there is some juicy speculation about how the Jason Kidd-Frank Vogel dynamic will play out, from a balance standpoint on the bench, there is some logic to it.
Well, and let's hope that LeBron James is really animated this season, because there were so many times last year he kind of looked to me like he's as great as he is. I mean, it sounds strange for a guy that talented to say he was going through the motions, but his heart didn't look in it a lot.
Well, as Bill said, he's around veterans now, and he doesn't have to sit and teach them every little part of this game. He's not changing diapers anymore on the NBA level. He's actually got grown-ups around him, and he's rested too. He's never had this kind of rest in what, almost a decade.
Oh, that's
Bill,
a good point.
Yeah.
He had the whole long off
season. He's been in the finals every year for almost 10 years, and now he's got the whole offseason to rest, relax, and recuperate.
So with the Clippers, they are the favorites, I think it's safe to say, with Kawhi Leonard, his extraordinary year leading the Raptors to the title, Paul George, the second star that the Clippers had to get to get Leonard to sign with them. So as you look at this team, do they have a weakness, or are they poised to be the favorite?
The one thing that I don't think anyone knows is the weight of expectation. How will they handle it? I don't remember a Clipper team in my Los Angeles Clipper watching history that is as well regarded and is expected to do as much as this Clipper team. And if they don't, say they struggle, Paul George isn't going to be around for the first 10, maybe 15 games. If they're at a 500 level and they're not dominating the NBA, people are going to wonder, hey, wait a second, why aren't you beating everyone like we thought you were? And they're going to have to answer those questions. How will they handle having the weight of expectation on them? That's something that no one knows.
And especially if Kawhi is rested, because that's something Toronto did with him, right, during the
regular
season.
Load management, that's the new term.
Yeah, they gave him a lot of time off. Bill, what do you think is the Clippers' biggest challenge despite the huge talents?
I think it's just a matter of coming together. I mean, you're integrating... you have a group that actually has quite a bit more continuity than the Lakers do. When you look at guys like Patrick Beverley, Montrezl Harrell, Lou Williams, guys who've really kind of helped make up the fabric of that team and its identity over the last few years. So it's just integrating the guys that you got. But I do see them as the favorite in the West long term. But what's interesting, and you go back to A talking about the sense of inevitability around a hallway series in the Western Conference Finals. The West is really, really good outside of L.A. When you have teams like Denver, who won the West last year as a young kind of, not a team without a superstar, but certainly a balanced group. Utah is kind of built the same way around Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert now. And also Houston now with Russell Westbrook and James Harden.
So that's going to be fun.
And Lakers getting to the Western Conference Finals, they might prove to be the best two teams at the end of the year.
Notice Bill didn't mention Golden State.
Yeah. Of course, with their loss of their big forward who goes to Brooklyn, but is out for the whole year, isn't he?
Kevin Durant's
gone
not playing
for
this year,
All right, A, thanks so much, Bill. Appreciate it very much. And Bill Oram, also someone to follow on Twitter. Always interesting insights.